You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a reporter about the dangers of transporting oil through the Mackinac Straits between Lakes Michigan and Huron.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. It's Inauguration Day in Washington, D.C. Donald Trump was sworn in as the 45th President of the United States earlier today.
There are protests happening around the country this weekend, including a women's march on Washington and the nation's capital tomorrow, and local protests planned, including marches in Madison and Milwaukee.
Robert Menser joins us now to look at today's inauguration through a Wisconsin lens and to share other top stories from the past week. He's a storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau, and he joins us every Friday for a look at the week's top news. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
So Inauguration Day in D.C. and Wisconsin lawmakers, some of them there, some of them not. Wisconsin residents, a lot of them we were hearing about, went to the inauguration in various capacities. And starting with Wisconsin residents, so what do we know about who went?
Yeah, so I don't want to spoil anything for listeners who maybe set their DVR and haven't watched yet, but we may have a new president. I'll leave it in them in suspense. But so obviously all eyes are on Washington D.C. today, and probably are going to stay there through this weekend. Trump was sworn in at noon Eastern time, and so we're sort of used to seeing a lot of Wisconsinites in prominent political positions, and Speaker of the House Paul Ryan was hanging around in the room after when Trump went to sign his official cabinet nominations. There was one member of the Wisconsin delegation who did not witness the inauguration, and that was U.S. Representative Mark Pocan, the Democrat of Madison, was one of 67 Democrats in Congress who skipped the ceremony. He made that announcement after Trump, then President-elect Trump, got into fight and insulted civil rights hero John Lewis, who is Pocan's colleague in the House.
And how did that how did that decision of Representative Pocan's go over with constituents? Do we know?
Well, so Pocan represents Madison, so he probably doesn't need to be too concerned about the political implications of skipping. But I mean, it's worth noting everyone else in Wisconsin delegation did attend, including Senator Tammy Baldwin, who's going to be up for reelection next year. There was a sort of a moment during the fight with John Lewis where there was a question of how much it would spread, how many Democrats would end up boycotting, but most didn't, as it turned out, and it's significant that Pocan comes from the most liberal part of the state, probably.
And we have there is a women's march on Washington tomorrow, and here in Wisconsin there are similar events. So what do we know about what's happening there?
Yeah, so we've seen some, protests are happening in Washington right now. Tomorrow, though, is the day of the big organized women's march on Washington, as well as sister events all around the country. The protest in Madison is likely to be the largest one in Wisconsin, but there are some events happening at the same time in Eau Claire, in Minocqua. There's an event happening in downtown Wausau, and there are others as well around Wisconsin. So, I know in social media, I see a lot of Wisconsinites who are headed to Washington probably right now. There are others who will set out for Madison tomorrow morning. So tomorrow will be another big day of demonstration.
We're talking with Rob Menser right now, storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin, talking about the latest in Wisconsin news. And Rob, on Wednesday, the Legislative Fiscal Bureau raised its tax collection projections by $454.6 million. What happened?
Yeah, so, well, I mean, first of all, these are estimates. It's not cash in hand, but, I mean, this is a significant revision as Wisconsin heads into a budget year. So the Legislative Fiscal Bureau is a nonpartisan agency that sort of crunches these numbers, and they do these projections regularly. The last one came out in November, and it looked kind of bad. It was projecting a deficit, and, there was good economy. economy in the second half of last year, economic growth projected for this year. And, you know, when you have more economic activity, it means more tax revenue. So also significant, it looks like there's a projection that spending looks like it's going to come in low. State spending was maybe $226 million below projection. That's as well as the $455 million additional tax revenue. So, you know, who knows whether, you know, sometimes these things are right and sometimes they're not. But if these projections hold or are close to what shapes up, it will give legislators some breathing room as they work out the details of the state budget.
And has Governor Walker said anything about the projected good financial news?
Well, so this is good economic news, period. This is a good thing. And so, you know, the teams go to their corners, right? Absolutely, Governor Walker holds this up as demonstration that this is economic growth. So he's the governor, and he will credit his policies to that. Democratic response is that the increase, the revenue increase in this projection is still lower than what was projected when the budget was passed, and that is true. The economy is growing, but you know, you can argue that it should be growing more. So there's no way to feel bad about a growing economy. A growing economy is good for Wisconsin, period. But there is debate around the edges about who gets credit or could it be better, or so on and so forth.
And Rob, before we move on, any thoughts about what this could mean for the upcoming budget?
I mean, it's hard to know. So there's still going to be all the same budget, big budget fights. Just today, Republican leaders in the Assembly were out with a big proposal calling for a bunch of new tax money for transportation and a $300 million tax cut that would offset that. Now, as proposed, that's not directly related, but it shows how these are big numbers and big numbers get moved around. You know, if there's a small surplus, it's likely that many Republicans are going to see that as an opportunity to cut taxes more. And at the same time, the legislators have already made some commitments to increase funding for the UW system or for K-12 public schools. It's a bit hard to predict, but it's just basically the thing to know is that it's better to have more revenue than not.
And Rob, our last story today, there is an interesting news item about Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark and a passenger from Wisconsin on an airplane leaving Dallas. And it's unclear exactly what happened, but there was quite a bit of drama there. What happened?
Boy, oh boy, this story has a little something for everyone. So this was last weekend. This was on Sunday, on the day of the playoff game between the Packers and the Cowboys. Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark is a Cowboys fanatic, and he was on the airplane dressed all in Cowboys gear. A Milwaukee resident named Dan Black, who is 24 years old, saw him on the plane, said, "Are you Sheriff Clark?" And then shook his head from side to side at David Clark in disapproval, Black says, of his Cowboys gear. And so now, you know, whatever you think, Clark is an elected official from Wisconsin dressed in Cowboys gear. So that, at the minimum, that's a counterintuitive move. So then the plane lands in Milwaukee, and lo and behold, there are six uniformed deputies and two dogs there. And this guy, Dan Black, is escorted out of the airport all the way to his friend's car. He's detained and questioned by police because he shook his head at Clark. So he's filed a complaint against the sheriff's department, and since then Clark has taken to social media to taunt and make fun of this private citizen. So it's a bit of an outrageous story, but it's hard not to be interested.
And we leave it there. Rob, thank you so much for joining us this week.
Thank you.
That was Robert Menser, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. And he joins us at the end of every week to look back at the top news stories. The proposed Dakota Access Pipeline drew thousands of protesters to the Great Plains this fall. Many people were upset that the pipeline was going to be tunneled under the Missouri River, which they said was a proposed threat to the river. But there's another pipeline that carries more barrels of oil per day than the Dakota line would, and it's at the bottom of the Mackinac Straits, just between Lakes Michigan and Huron.
Dan Egan joins us to tell us more. He's a reporter covering the Great Lakes for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, looking at the Mackinac Straits, this was a pretty bold project to put this pipeline there. What are some of the challenges in this site of putting an oil pipeline down there?
Well, I mean, the line was built in 1953, and at that time, nothing like it had ever been attempted in terms of the length that it would stretch underwater, which is about 4 miles, and the depth that the pipe, and there's actually two pipes, two twin pipes, the depth that the pipes would go to, and it's about 250 feet. The challenge is to build a line or two lines that won't leak, because history shows that pipelines eventually do leak. They did a heck of a job. These twin pipes are roughly twice as thick as any other pipes in the system of oil pipelines running through the Great Lakes Basin. But they're also old. They're 63 years old now, and the company that owns and operates them says there's no reason to believe that they can't operate for what they say is, you know, the foreseeable future. In the foreseeable future, there's no reason to see the need for shutting them down. So in a lot of people's minds, the big question is, these lines got to come out at some point. Are they going to come out before they break or after they break?
And talk about the sensitivity of this spot connected to two of the major Great Lakes.
Sure. What's interesting is, say, the Dakota Access Pipeline, which is under construction. The construction's actually halted at the moment, but it's a pipeline out on the Great Plains. And it's been stalled, and a big reason it's been stalled is because of the threat it poses to the Missouri River, which is a drinking water source for the nearby Standing Rock Sioux tribe and a lot more people downstream. The plan, as I understand it, though, is to tunnel under the river at depths from 90 to 115 feet to protect the water above. Now, in the Straits of Mackinac, they did very little tunneling. The lines are underwater until they reach a depth of 65 feet, and then they tunneled in, under the bottom of the straits to a depth of 65 feet, and from there on out they run basically on the surface of the lake bottom. They've recently been installing some supports where the pipes span unsupported areas where they're basically sagging between undulations on the lake bottom. The problem here is the Mackinac Straits aren't like anywhere else in the Great Lake. There's a tremendous volume of water that moves through this pinch point between Lake Michigan and Lake Huron. The two lakes were actually separated about 8,000 years ago, connected only by a river. And in a sense, that river's still there. There is a lot of water. It's been estimated a volume 10 times greater than that going over Niagara Falls flows through the straits at any given moment. What's interesting is it doesn't always flow from Lake Michigan into Lake Huron. Depending on weather and currents, it can flow the opposite way. So if you get a leak in there, you don't know where the oil is going to go, but it could go west into Lake Michigan. It could go east into Lake Huron. It's certainly likely to go toward Mackinac City and Mackinac Island, you know, some of the most prized areas of all the Great Lakes. So it's a real churning current that can take the oil in basically every direction. The scientists who have studied this from the University of Michigan in a study funded by the National Wildlife Federation say there is not a worse place in all the Great Lakes for an oil spill. And there is not a place in the Great Lakes, as I understand it, where there are two pipes lying exposed on the lake bottom. So it's a situation.
You write that environmental groups have raised concerns, citizens groups in different communities, but also the Republican Attorney General of Michigan has been raising concerns about this. What kind of concerns are we seeing from leadership there in Michigan?
Well, right now, there's a task force put together, and the Attorney General is leading that task force, and they have commissioned two studies. One is to look at what would be the environmental and economic damages of a spill if it were to happen in the Straits, and the other is what's an alternative route? If these pipes are plugged, how's this oil going to get to refineries and to market? Those studies are expected to be completed sometime later this year, and if anybody's guessed what they're going to say, it's just beyond the Michigan political leadership. There really is a grassroots movement looking very skeptically at the existence of these pipes that have been there for so long, especially because they're operated by a company that doesn't have a great track record in Michigan. And when I say that, I'm specifically referring to the Kalamazoo River spill in 2010, when an Enbridge-owned pipe burst and spilled more than a million gallons into a tributary of the Kalamazoo River, and a cleanup that followed cost more than $1 billion.
Talking to Dan Egan from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a pair of pipelines running underneath the point where Lake Huron and Michigan meet, concerns about the future of those pipelines. Dan, Enbridge under fire on this. What have they said about the safety of the lines and their readiness to deal with a possible leak?
Well, they're confident in the line's safety, and, you know, I guess you would expect them to be, because if they break, it's going to cost them a lot of money. We'll know how much money when these studies are completed later this year. But they maintain that there's regular maintenance going on. The lines are being surveyed both from within and without. They've got special devices that they can send through the pipe, detecting any kind of potential corrosion or cracks. Weaknesses, and they say they're confident that the pipes are in good shape. But pipes leak, and, you know, if they were just they're always confident that their pipes aren't going to leak. Otherwise, they wouldn't be running them on any given day. On the other hand, they've been averaging in the recent decade, they were averaging, I believe, about 70 spills a year. So their confidence isn't necessarily shared by people who don't own and operate the pipe.
And then the other question, and you touched on this earlier, is given that people want this oil to get from point A to point B, the alternatives are rail, trucks across the Mackinac Bridge, by lake, of course, and you write about an explosion, fortunately, of an empty tanker ship in Sarnia, Ontario. The other ways to transport oil all raise their own concerns, don't they?
Absolutely. I mean, pipelines are the safest way to move oil. That's pretty commonly accepted. There are alternatives beyond pipes under the Straits, though, and they wouldn't go over too well here in Wisconsin. One of them wouldn't go over too well here in Wisconsin, and that would be to route it through an existing right-of-way that Enbridge owns. It currently has four pipes in that 80-foot right-of-way that runs the length of the state from Superior to the Illinois border. They could presumably put another line there, but that would just mean more oil flowing through Wisconsin and more risk and exposure for the people who live along the line. As far as putting it on boats, I've never met anybody who said, yes, that's a great idea, although there are some business interests who have pursued it, and their application to build a loading facility in Superior to move some of this oil across the lakes has been withdrawn from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. But the more pressure that gets put on these pipes, and to, if not close them, restrict the way they operate, the more pressure there's going to be to move the oil in other ways, and one of them could be boats on the lake. And it's been done before. It's not being done now. There is gasoline moved on the lakes, but oil is a bit trickier, because if you have a spill, it's a lot more difficult to clean up and a lot more potentially damaging.
So you mentioned the studies underway in Michigan. Do we know when this is all going to come to a head and decisions will be made about the future of this pipe?
No. I don't know when those studies are going to be completed. I think sometime in the summer or maybe fall, I don't know what's going to be done with them. It's going to take, I don't know what it's going to take for somebody to make a decision on, say, to shut them down, because that's a tough decision to make. Mm-hmm. Because if you shut these lines down and they seem to be operating fine, all anybody is going to remember is that we had two perfectly good lines and we shut them down, and now we have a problem moving this oil by some other means. So you really don't know the benefit of prevention. On the other hand, if you wait until there's a break, all anybody's going to remember is how could we have let this happen? It was just sitting there, and it was obvious to a lot of people that this was an unacceptable risk, and it wasn't appropriately dealt with. So it's going to be a tough decision, one way or the other.
We'll leave it there for now. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Dan Egan, reporter covering the Great Lakes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about the oil pipelines in the Mackinac Straits.
Barack Obama and his wife Michelle left Washington earlier today on a helicopter after Donald Trump was sworn in as America's 45th president. As the presidential transition comes to a close, we're looking back at Obama's legacy.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is the legacy of Barack Obama as president? How do you think he'll be remembered in history books? Call in now and share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Niambi Carter joins us now. She's an assistant professor of political science at Howard University. Niambi, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica, for having me.
Well, let's start with a clip from President Obama's farewell speech in Chicago last week.
If I had told you 8 years ago that America would reverse a great recession, reboot our auto industry, and unleash the longest stretch of job creation in our history, if I had told you that we would open up a new chapter with the Cuban people, shut down Iran's nuclear weapons program without firing a shot, take out the mastermind of 9/11. If I had told you that we would win marriage equality and secure the right to health insurance for another 20 million of our fellow citizens, if I had told you all that, you might have said our sights were set a little too high.
Barack Obama there in his farewell speech as president in Chicago last week. And Niambi, he listed his accomplishments there. What would you say, though, is the most significant aspect of Barack Obama's presidency?
I mean, I think that's a hard one, but I would say the Affordable Care Act, actually. I think that was probably one of the most far-reaching and impactful things he did while in office.
And what about the fact that it may be, looks likely to be, dismantled by Donald Trump and a Republican legislature? Does that diminish the accomplishment that you see there at all?
No, I don't think it diminishes the accomplishment. I think it speaks to the ways in which Republicans were able to frame the issue to confuse people, because the Affordable Care Act is actually popular. Obamacare is very unpopular. And I think what we're seeing now is people who actually relied on the Affordable Care Act may have actually voted against their own interests because they weren't quite sure what the distinction was. And there is none.
Now, looking big picture now, some liberals, including Cornel West, have criticized Barack Obama for what they saw as not going far enough to the left in his policies overall. What do you think of those critics and what they saw as something as an opportunity missed?
I understand the criticism. I think Obama has gotten a lot of flack for seeming too measured, particularly around racial issues, for example, with the deaths last year of Philando Castile and others, that he just didn't say enough so that he could talk about the police shootings in Dallas and say that the murders of police were reprehensible, but was seeming to take a more measured tone when police were killing, in this case, black citizens. And then I think there was also a lot of sensibility that with even the Affordable Care Act, that he didn't do enough to provide actual basic health care to all citizens, which would have been, I think, the more leftist ideal. Instead, people actually have to buy insurance from private companies. So I think there were a number of critiques of him. But I also think we have to understand that he can't do everything on his own. And so he had to do what he could under some really kind of bounded circumstances.
We're talking with Nyambi Carter right now, looking at the legacy of Barack Obama as he leaves office, left Washington earlier today. And Nyambi, looking at the economy, that seems like a strong point for Barack Obama. Maybe 4 years ago, it wouldn't have been so obvious. Today, though, the economy is looking strong, not perfect, but it's better than it was. And he had the stimulus package as part of that, help for the auto industry, for banks. What do you think? Where do you think he'll stand as far as the economy goes?
I mean, I think history will look kindly on Barack Obama because stock markets are doing well. As you noted, the banking and auto industries are still around. That saved jobs. Those are sound things to do. And also unemployment came down. I mean, I think it's sort of a mixed bag because he started at a place where we were doing so poorly that any progress looked like great progress. But at the same time, I think given where we were 8 years ago, it was pretty abysmal that no one necessarily saw that we would be doing as well as we are today, especially in light of some of our partners around the world.
Now, if you had to put your finger on an area of policy where you felt that he stumbled, what would you point to?
I mean, I would still say, I mean, we have not gotten out of our military relationships abroad. And I think thinking about our involvement in Afghanistan is something that he hasn't seemed to be really able to extricate us from. And then Guantanamo Bay, if you recall, part of what he ran on was saying, I'm going to close Guantanamo Bay, that the existence of Guantanamo Bay seems to be offensive to American ideas about civil rights and civil liberties, and I'm going to close it, but that still has not happened. So I think those are places where he certainly did not go and do the things that he said he was going to do.
And looking at policy in the Middle East, the historian Doris Kearns Goodwin had a conversation with Barack Obama as president, and he confided to her that he felt that maybe his failing that he saw was Syria, that he just was not able to come up with a policy that would be effective. And she said he didn't see it as that he had two choices and he picked the wrong one, but that maybe there was another path, another option that would have been more effective. And Syria, and looking at that as the rise of ISIS as well, being tied into that, do you think that's something that will loom as a shadow over his presidency?
I mean, I think so. I mean, I think most of us have had our consciousness just shocked and appalled by some of the images coming out of Syria, of Syrian citizens being killed, of children being harmed and maimed. And it felt like we didn't do anything, like we just sort of forgot about it or just ignored it, and that he kind of kicked the can down the road for the next administration. So I certainly feel that. In terms of him being blamed for the rise of ISIS, I'm not sure that there's any one factor that led to the rise of ISIS, and I certainly don't know enough to suggest or to say with any certainty that ISIS became fully formed in these last 8 years. But no doubt the ascendancy of ISIS, which is sort of this loose configuration of groups that are sort of pledging allegiance to an idea in a certain kind of way rather than a nation state, is something that I think scares a lot of Americans and a lot of people around the world because of these different attacks that have happened across Europe and parts of the continent of Africa, and that it just sort of fell off of our radar somehow. And I think this is one of those moments, though, when you see the sort of limits of military action to deal with ideas.
We're talking right now with Niambi Carter from Harvard University, and we're taking a look at Barack Obama's legacy.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you think the 44th president will be remembered for? What do you think is Barack Obama's legacy? How do you think history books will remember him? And what are you going to remember about Obama's presidency? How has the former president affected your life or your community, your country? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll continue this conversation with Howard University's Niambi Carter in just a bit here on Central Time. We're picking up our discussion about the legacy of Barack Obama with Niambi Carter, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Howard University.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What will you remember about Barack Obama and his presidency? What do you think his legacy will be? How will history look back at him? And did you see Barack Obama affecting your life? For better or worse, call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Jason joining us in Park Falls. Jason, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to share?
Well, I would say Obama's legacy would be Donald Trump, that his policies led the American people to stand up. And today we see that Donald Trump is going to reverse, I believe, a lot of what Obama did. And also, yeah, the economy got stabilized, but it was by pumping $12 trillion of debt into it, making it over the long run very unstable.
Jason, thank you for the call. And Niambi, I want to ask you about that. Critics say that Barack Obama left his party in worse condition than he found it. Republicans control both chambers of Congress and the White House. And what do you make of that aspect of what he left behind, what Jason was getting at there?
Well, I mean, I think that's a bit unfair. I mean, the truth is the party didn't do itself any service, right? I mean, the DNC, Obama's the sort of figurehead as the head of the party, but the DNC is an independent organization. And I think one of the things that we saw this summer is that the DNC perhaps may be a bit more conservative than its members, and there may be some real thought behind how to make the DNC speak to its membership. The other thing is who campaigned where, because Donald Trump didn't win the popular vote. Now, it's not the first time we've had a president who didn't win the popular vote, but I think to suggest that his win was more than something strategic is maybe a bit of an overstatement. He did not win the popular vote, and I don't think that's a small thing. So I don't think it's fair to say Obama left his party in worse condition. I mean, I think we still have midterms coming up, so we'll see how good people feel about Donald Trump, as he's had one of the most unpopular transitions in recent memory, and what that looks like for Republicans in the House and in the Senate.
Jason, thank you for that call. And we're going to go next to Jeanette joining us in Ladysmith. Jeanette, hi.
Hi. Sort of a little bit of a roll back to the mention of Syria.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're doing Mr. Obama, President Obama, a disservice, and we do it to other people in government as well, through lack of Americans, I think, have a disturbing lack of knowledge of history and geography and what goes on in other parts of the world. This is not the first time horrific things have happened in Syria. Syria was involved in the Armenian genocide at the beginning of the 20th century. This is, in a sense, as I was watching this stuff on Aleppo, this is almost like a repeat of that. So how can we be judging Barack Obama harshly when we've seen this before? And I don't believe the United States did anything at that time, and I would like to hear other people's opinion on this, and I'll take them off the air.
Jeanette, thank you for that call. And Niambi, what would you say to that? She's saying that this is a situation that has seen trouble before, and that Barack Obama should not bear sole responsibility for what happened.
I mean, I agree with Jeanette. I mean, we don't even have to go as far back to Syria. We can think about what didn't happen with Rwanda and Burundi, right, in the 90s under Clinton's watch. I mean, that was a horrible genocide, and we did little. We did little in Sudan, and we saw what happened there. And there are other places around the world where those things have happened. So I agree that it's unfair to lay it all at Barack Obama's feet. But I do think I think the sensibility that America should be the sort of world's cop and intervene in these kinds of events is of common sensibility. But I don't know if it would have been a popular move, and I'm not saying it was just a strategic concern that he didn't get involved. I don't think it was just that. But I can't imagine that it didn't at least cross their mind what would have been at stake had we gotten tied up militarily somehow in Syria.
Jeanette, thanks a lot for the call. And Yambe, I want to ask you, we should touch on Barack Obama as the first African-American president of the United States and the meaning of that. How would you frame that meeting? And also, you know, 2 terms, 8 years as president and scandal-free 8 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this speaks to sort of that pressure lots of excluded groups feel when they become the first at something, which is to sort of be above board in every way. And I'm not suggesting that Barack Obama or any person, you know, go out finding scandals. But it was very clear that he had to be on guard because he was the first. And I think for a lot of people, they don't recognize how important it is to see people in these positions as models of what you can be and prototypes of what you can be. The fact that we have never, out of 45 presidents, had someone other than a white man be a president of the United States, I think says a lot about what he and his family, Michelle, Sasha, Maria, in the White House meant for so many of us who live in this country and yet don't feel a part of it in the same kinds of ways, because we can't point to pictures in history books of presidents and first ladies that look like us or first families that look like us in some way, shape, or form. And I think beyond just what it meant for him to be the first, it did do something to people's esteem, and it does give people a way to think about what is possible for them and for people who look like them or something like them.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Mark joining us next in Richland Center. Mark, hi.
Hello. You know, Dwight Eisenhower warned against the military-industrial complex, and not a single president except for Kennedy has heeded that warning. So now we've got another guy who simply just... he bombed 7 different countries and dropped in just his last year alone 26,000-something bombs on people, and mostly people of color, by the way. So I don't really think this guy's a peace president, and I don't think his legacy will be anything but just more warmongering that Eisenhower warned us against.
Mark, thanks for the call. And Yambe, what's your response to that?
I mean, I think there are a lot of critiques that that Americans had of Obama's military policy and drone strikes and other things about the legality and also the dangers, even potentially killing American citizens abroad using those technologies. But I think, you know, I don't think he will be dinged on that in terms of his legacy, in that to a certain extent, that kind of strident nature is a very American thing. I'm not saying it's a good or bad thing. It just is. That kind of cowboy mentality is something that is very much a present image. And he was often hit against by his political opponents for being too weak. So it'll be interesting. I mean, I don't necessarily think that he will be viewed as the warmonger, as Mark said, even though he was clearly not afraid to use force. But he was often talked about as being too weak. And I just think this is one of those things where ideology comes into play in terms of how we think about Obama and his military legacy.
Mark, thanks for the call. And yesterday was Obama's last full day in office. And on that day, he announced over 300 commutations for nonviolent drug offenders. Yambe, how does that play into Barack Obama's potential legacy?
I mean, I think it's huge. I mean, the truth is we have gotten different kinds of criminal justice reform under Obama. So, for example, bringing down the disparities between crack cocaine and powder cocaine. The problem with that, it wasn't retroactive. So people who had been sentenced under more draconian laws about powder and crack cocaine, or people who were sentenced under mandatory minimums, couldn't seek any relief. So I think it was at least an acknowledgement that nonviolent drug offenders are really not the people that we want to have in jail and in prison, excuse me, for life, for essentially being either low-level drug dealers or even drug users, that these are not the ways that we want to go about dealing with this. And I think the fact that he issued more commutations than anybody else is not a small thing, because Chelsea Manning was also a recipient of a commutation. And I think it will speak well of Obama, who I think cared deeply about criminal justice reform, but was not able to execute on that.
Let's take another call here. We've got Alice joining us in Maple. Alice, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share? Go ahead.
I just want to say that I think Obama was a top-class act, him and his wife, and I think he will go down as one of the best presidents ever. And to be replaced by a bigot and a racist is just shameful for this country. I'm horrified, and I think it's a very, very, very dark day for many people.
Alice, thank you for your comment there. And you know, as we start to wrap up, you know, we got a little bit of time, but is it too early to be having this conversation? Obviously, this is the day of Donald Trump's inauguration, and not a lot of time has passed here. When is it too early to start asking these questions?
I don't think it's ever too early. I mean, I think since his election in November, we have seen people asking these questions, because I think people are really concerned that Donald Trump doesn't understand the job. He doesn't understand the enormity of the task. He doesn't understand the limitations of the position. He doesn't understand his constitutional responsibilities, his ethical responsibilities as president. He doesn't have the temperament for it. And I think a lot of people are concerned that his try and failure could really be catastrophic for many of us. And I think we're starting to see at least rumblings of that when we're talking about the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, when you're looking at about 20 million people losing health care coverage, and there's nothing to replace it with. I mean, I don't think these are times to not panic. This could kill people, and that's not an overstatement. So I think while this is his first day in office, from what we've seen throughout the election cycle and in the lead-up to him assuming office, people have a right to be concerned.
Niambi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Veronica.
That was Niambi Carter, assistant professor of political science at Howard University, and she joined us to talk about the legacy of Barack Obama.